So welcome back, everyone. This is the last stretch of our conference. As I mentioned in my opening remarks, we are very lucky to be able to now listen to the general conclusions, which will be delivered by Yannick Radi. I've decided this year to try this new format, which is to have general conclusions which open a final general discussion. I hope this will work, and you'll all be interesting and interested in discussing Yannick's conclusions and any loose ends of our conference. So the three commentators of the three panels are sitting here with us, but it doesn't mean that we'll just be discussing among ourselves, just in case you're afraid that this is what it's announcing. So without further ado, Yannick Radi, you have the floor.
Merci Samantha, c'est un grand plaisir pour moi de formuler les conclusions générales de cette si belle et si intéressante conférence. Merci également à ton équipe et au Collège de France pour leur accueil. To start this general conclusions, I would like to refer to a well-known reflection of Saint Augustine, which suits very well to consent in international law. What in discourse do we mention more familiarly and knowingly than time? But what is time? If nobody asks me, I know. But if I wish to explain it to someone who asks, I do not know. International lawyers face the same puzzlement with regards to consent. As mentioned by Professor Besson in her introductory remarks, consent is an old chestnut that still puzzles most theorists. More generally, and as I say by Professor Boisson de Chazourne, the international legal community presumes it understands consent, but do we really know what it means? So, what is it that international lawyers presume, rightly or wrongly, that state consent is the foundation of the international legal order, that consent is a matter of free will and acceptance? Acceptance of what? Of a rule, of a regime, or of international law as a whole? But beyond these presumptions, these ideas, we lack a clear and well-articulated view of state consent and more generally of consent in international law. The papers, the presentations we listened to, the discussions that we had together contributed greatly to enlighten us, both from the point of view of international legal theory and international legal practice. As a starting point, we can note that state consent needs to be and has been demythologized in both legal theory and in legal practice. In international legal practice, although states adhere to it in general, in abstracto, it is obvious that they do not hesitate to depart from it in concrete situations when their interests so require. In international legal theory, state consent has been criticized on grounds of morality and effectiveness. Obviously, the adherence of states to consent is a geometrie variable. Obviously, the hegemony of state consent leads to situations where, for instance, the lack of effectiveness of international law is without doubt. And yet, isn't state consent, both empirically and normatively speaking, the worst modality of government except for all the others, to paraphrase Winston Churchill? Well, it is likely so, I think. In a society like the international one, as it has existed since the 17th, 18th century, where there is no power, neither immanent nor transcendent, there can be no legitimate vertical relation of authority, but only relations between equals, each constituting its own power in a constitutional sense, if I may say. In a society like the international one, the legal system is based on autonomy. Law being made of the rules each of these equals consent to be bound by, or to put it differently, it is made of all the rules each of these equals gives to itself. As it appears, the concept of consent is linked to the concept of autonomy, and more precisely, consent is the manifestation of autonomy, its vector, its vehicle. Shedding light on this link between consent and autonomy not only allows us to better understand the concept of consent, but also to better understand how it operates in practice, its importance, its limits. This will constitute the focus and the common thread of my general conclusions. So, for that purpose, let me first lay the groundwork. What does autonomy mean and entail in international law? As I have just touched upon, being autonomous for states means that it gives to itself, through its consent, the rules that apply to it. Rules given to itself to regulate its conduct, primary rules, and rules given to itself to ensure the enforcement of those rules, secondary rules. As I will discuss in a few minutes, the autonomy of state is, with regard to primary rules, is at the core of the theory of sources. With regard to enforcement, beyond the obligation for states to settle their disputes pacifically, their autonomy is reflected in the free choice of means, a principle which is recalled in the UNGA Resolution 2625. States are autonomous in that regard, as they can decide the method to be used to settle the disputes to which they are parties. Compared to domestic legal orders, this autonomy is particularly remarkable with regards to adjudication, on which I will focus in my conclusions. But, and this is crucial, it is wrong to have an abstract, a decontextualized understanding of autonomy. There are limits to the exercise of autonomy, and thereby to consent, which are inherent to the two components of the term autonomy, auto and nomos. So let's start with auto, giving oneself its own rules. Such an exercise does not and cannot take place in a societal vacuum. There are societal constraints linked to the relation with others and events, which leave no other choice to the self than taking into account otherness in the exercise of its autonomy, and even sometimes to abdicate. What about the limits to the exercise of autonomy and thereby to consent that derive from the feature of nomos? Well, rules, systems of rules, the law, have inner features which come as a limit to the hegemony of the self, which gives to itself its own rules. Indeed, international law is an open textual language, a language that then needs to be interpreted in light of the conflicting epistemic forces and of the conflicting societal dynamics which are at play within the international society and within the international community. Overall, and as we will see in the course of this presentation, all these constraints pertaining to the self, auto, and to the law, nomos, reveal how the exercise of autonomy and thereby how consenting to international law consists fundamentally in a dialectic collective practice. So to shed light on all this, I will successively discuss the two main categories analyzed by the panelists in their papers and during these 2 days, lawmaking and dispute settlement. Based on these discussions, I will then address prospectively in a concluding part the future of consent in international legal theory and practice. So, consent in international lawmaking. So to analyze consent here, I would like, for the sake of clarity, to focus successively on the theory of sources and then on institutional lawmaking, even though there are, of course, overlaps between them, in particular in relation to treaties. So at the core of the theory of sources, which underpins Article 38 of the ICG Statute and the views defended by voluntarists like Prosper Veil, who is certainly not a post-voluntarist, there is the hegemony of state autonomy and that of state consent. Obviously, this radical approach fails to take into account the interplay, the dialectic between the individual state and the group of state within which autonomy is exercised. This is true in relation to both the role of state consent and the nature of state consent. With regard to the role of state consent, and as noted by Professor Pellet, the consent load of the formal sources vary from one source to the other. There is a sliding scale with, on the one side, general principles of law recognized by civilized nations, where consent plays no role, and treaties, where it plays the most important one, each state giving, having to express its consent to be bound. The importance of state autonomy in treaties is also apparent in reservations, which, as coined by Samantha, constitute kind of pockets of disagreement, pocket in which each state can give to itself its own rules, or I should rather say, pockets in which each state can decide not to give to itself the rules agreed on by state parties. That being said, in relation to the dialectic between the individual state and the group of state, it is worth insisting that there is no parallel between the process of entry into a treaty and the process of terminating it, which depends on state parties collectively. When a state has consented to be bound by a treaty, to use the words of Professor Pellet, the trap closes, and its will is captive and will be freed only through processes in which the will of an individual state will have little or nothing to do. The prevalence of the group of states over the individual state also holds true with regard to customary international law. Indeed, and irrespective of whether the doctrine of the two elements really amount to an exercise of autonomy, it is worth noting that this doctrine requires a general acceptance and not that of individual states. As a result, a state can be bound by customary international law without having consented to it. There is, of course, the persistent objector doctrine that was discussed this morning, and which, so to say, allows each state to preemptively decide not to give to itself the upcoming rule which will derive from the acceptance by the group of states of the corresponding general practice. But it is fair to say that this doctrine has little relevance in real international life. Let's now move on to from the role of consent to the nature of consent. In the international society, setting aside unilateral acts, states' autonomy materializes in bilateralism and in multilateralism. This societal necessity means that states are faced with one another to give themselves their own rules. And this entails that their footprint in that process depends on the bargaining power of each. In this respect, Professor Pellet claimed that to consent is not to will. Well, in any case, the consent given by states when exercising their autonomy does not always reflect an affirmative attitude, no doubt, but rather something more passive. Even though the coercion of a state representative or of the state itself is prohibited under the law of treaties, consenting to treaties obviously displays such diverse attitudes. This is true as well with regard to customary international law. Indeed, irrespective again of whether or not this two-element theory amounts to an exercise of autonomy, there is no doubt that the attitude of states depends here as well on their respective bargaining power. So, as it appears, the dialectic between the individual state and the group of state is key to understand the diversity that characterizes the nature of consent and to understand the role of consent. Consent, autonomy, are limited by the societal context in which the self, auto, gives to itself its own rules. This applies mutatis mutandis to institutional lawmaking I am now turning to. So institutional lawmaking nowadays takes place in two types of settings, which for the sake of the discussion can be said to stand within and outside international law. The former includes lawmaking in international organizations and in treaty regimes. The latter refers to all those processes often labeled informal lawmaking. At play in those settings, there is not only the dialectic between the individual state and the group of state, but there is also the dialectic between states and other entities. Here, I would like to focus on institutional lawmaking within international law. I will be pleased to discuss and to address informal lawmaking during our discussions. So, within international law. The lawmaking processes which are at play in international organizations and in treaty regimes display paradoxical trends with regard to state consent. On the one hand, mechanisms like majority-based decision-making processes limit state consent. They limit the exercise by each state of its autonomy, law being made of the rules that the group of state decides to give to itself. So, of course, there exist opt-out mechanisms which confer to each state the possibility not to give to itself the rules agreed on by the group. It remains that this trend can be analyzed as leading, as put by Professor Berman, to the disaggregation of state consent. But, on the other hand, another trend is at play in which, to use the terms of Professor Besson and Professor Amati, state consent strangles international organizations from within. The archetypal example of this is, of course, the veto power of the permanent members of the Security Council. In this in the context of that trend, the exercise of its autonomy by one state, or I should rather say, the refusal to make the best of it, prevents, or at least makes it more difficult for the others to give to themselves collectively their own rules. As aptly put by Professor Brunet in relation to the climate regime, the interplay between the individual and collective aspects of the consent process can have a dark side by slowing down the progress in the regimes towards more ambitious requirements or even result in a standstill. But le droit est la plus puissante des écoles de l'imagination, as said by Hector, one of the characters in La guerre de Troie n'aura pas lieu, the play of Jean Giraudoux. Indeed, new mechanisms are created to endeavor to cope with the inextricable situation in which the dialectic between the individual state and the group of state can lead us, despite the emergency of situations like global warming and climate change. This is illustrated by the non-binding nationally determined contributions under the Paris Agreement. As said again by Professor Brunet, such a bottom-up approach is remarkable. To unlock the situation, it disentangles the individual and collective dimension of consent under the auspices of an international agreement. But also remarkable, I believe, such a mechanism ties together the international legal order and domestic legal orders, and confers a key role to domestic courts, which can be sized, and which have actually been sized on those matters. This is another illustration of the status, argued by some, of domestic courts as agents of the international community. It remains, unfortunately, that such a mechanism will likely fail to be effective in the very short period of time that we have left to limit global warming and its consequences. This is notably this lack of effectiveness of the institutional lawmaking processes within international law, captured by states' autonomy, which are often said to have triggered institutional lawmaking outside international law. But again, let's discover this side of the normative world later during our discussion. I now would like to turn to state consent in international dispute settlement. So, in international law, autonomy also pertains to dispute settlement. As said in the introduction, states can decide the method to be used to settle the disputes to which they are parties. They can notably opt for adjudication, on which I will focus here. This autonomy translates into the consent to be given for international courts and tribunals to have jurisdiction to settle disputes, as well as into the delimitation of the scope of that consent. Likewise, with regard to applicable law, the rules to be applied by those courts and tribunals are the ones that the disputing parties consented to, the one that they have given to themselves, as I have just explained. It is worth emphasizing, as Professor Times does, that while state consent is more important in the adjudicatory setting than it is in any other setting, states renounce control over it therein more fully than elsewhere. This is, according to him, the necessary implication of two prerogatives of those courts and tribunals, competence, whatever language you prefer, and the power of courts and tribunals to authoritatively resolve disputes. But as I said in the introduction, and as I will argue here, this is also the necessary implication of the inner feature of nomos, of international law. Let's shed light on all this with regard to first jurisdiction and then applicable law. So, in her paper, Professor Boisson de Chazoun analyzes consent to jurisdiction in investor-state arbitration. Beyond the acute societal implications of raised by consent in this field, investor-state arbitration constitute an incomparable archetype to discuss the limits placed to consent in jurisdictional matters. For that reason, I will also use investor-state arbitration for the purpose of my discussion, while acknowledging, of course, that the scope of the limit placed to consent is regime-specific. So, in reference to Guarantee Kotza versus Turkmenistan, Professor Boisson de Chazoun reminds us that the interpretation of consent is fundamental, as the principle of competence de la competence requires an international court or a tribunal to establish the extent and limits of its jurisdiction objectively on the basis of the title of jurisdiction. Establishing the extent and limits of jurisdiction objectively. Objectively, I think this is the key term and the key objective to ensure that state consent to jurisdiction is respected. This objectivity requires, notably from courts and tribunals, that they interpret compromissory clauses neither liberally nor restrictively. This is often recalled by investor-state arbitration tribunal, as it was by Rosalind Higgins in relation to the case law of the ICJ. But there is a problem. The problem is that the reasoning to determine the scope of a compromissory clause can be seen by some as being restrictive and by others as not being restrictive. For instance, in Daimler versus Argentina, the majority of the tribunal considered that the requirement to have affirmative evidence of consent does not amount to a restrictive approach, while the dissenting arbitrator considered that it does. So, question, where does objectivity stand then? This directs our attention towards interpretation and the limits that the inner feature of international law places to state consent, an issue that I will discuss further in relation to applicable law. Here, I simply would like to stress that with regard to the interpretation of compromissory clauses, among other type of clauses, the issue is not only, and likely not mainly, their lack of clarity, but the clash between the various epistemic forces which are at play within the investor-state arbitration community. Indeed, the interpretation of these clauses is conducted by arbitrators who have different views about the legal principle, the values, and the interest underpinning investor-state arbitration. I think this is fundamental. Think, for instance, about the conflicting views about the status of preconditions to arbitration, or the applicability of the most favored nation clause to the dispute settlement mechanism of BITs that we discussed yesterday. On these issues, conflicting interpretation of the same treaty provisions by tribunal's majority and dissenting arbitrators have spread in arbitral practice. The reasoning that they adopted are largely governed by the legal principles and values they relied on, and that are rooted in diverse corpus of law and disciplines, notably public international law, commercial arbitration, and private law. As a result, interpretation reached by some tribunals or arbitrators have given a picture of state consent that states have failed to recognize. I will get back to the relation between the intention of treaty parties and the interpretation reached by tribunals with regard to applicable law. Here, and to conclude on state consent to jurisdiction, I just would like to emphasize the practical consequences of those decisions establishing jurisdiction in its scope, which are not seen as being objective by states. In investor-state arbitration, this has undermined the trust in the regime, and it has contributed to its crisis. And yet, in her dissenting opinion in Guarantee Kozza versus Turkmenistan, Professor Boisson de Chazon warned the arbitral community in this respect, writing, I quote, that the trust and confidence in third-party adjudication is dependent on the respect by international courts and tribunals of the limits of the jurisdiction conferred upon them. Trust, confidence, as we will see, the same type of considerations apply mutatis mutandis in relation to applicable law. So here I will focus on treaties and will limit myself to a few remarks. I'm pleased to discuss that further with you during our discussion. So, as already said yesterday, Professor Allott wrote that a treaty is not the end of a process, but the beginning of another process. A process in which, as noted by Professor Besson, interpretation is marked by disagreements. The disagreements in the interpretative process can be of two types, both of them being very telling about the role of state consent in relation to state intent, and also very telling about the limits that state consent faces with regard to applicable law. So the first type of disagreements, and actually we haven't discussed this one much during these 2 days, are the disagreements between the state parties themselves. In disputes, states are typically adopting different views about the meaning of the rules at hand. They have a different idea of what they consented to. Such views are sometimes, often, based on bad faith, a party or the disputing parties refusing to do justice to their ab initio common intention. In other situations, the issue does not boil down to bad faith, but simply to the lack of an ab initio common intention. This is so in particular when the rules at hand were on purpose left ambiguous. As explained by Guy Ladrette de la Charrière in La Politique Juridique Extérieure, states use this strategy in treaty drafting to continue, at the stage of treaty interpretation, their efforts to promote their interests. To paraphrase Clausewitz, the interpretation of treaty appears in such situation as the prolongation of disagreement by other means than treaty negotiation. In the adjudicatory setting, this is in fine to the adjudicator to deal with the matter and to provide an authoritative interpretation, which leads me actually to the second type of disagreements that can characterize the interpretative process in adjudicatory settings. Here, I'm referring to the disagreement between states and adjudicators. So these situations relate in particular to the very old debate that we have mentioned among international lawyers concerning the object of treaty interpretation. Does it aim at determining the meaning of the text, which is deemed to reflect the intent of the parties, or does it consist in an inquiry into their actual intent? In that regard, as said yesterday, there is a strong trend against the intentionalist paradigm in international legal theory and practice. The consequence of the focus on the text being that state consent is less compelling, as mentioned by Professor Zabiev yesterday. So, two remarks on this. First, and as noted by Professor Koskenniemi, it can be suggested that the reliance on the declared instead of the actual intent is in fact non-consensual. Why? It is so because its point can be seen as not being to give effect to the real will, but as being to meet the legitimate expectations of other states, notably of the acceding states that we mentioned yesterday. It would then aim at ensuring legal certainty. For this reason, it considered such an approach as a standard of justice. This would be another illustration of the role of legal principles and values in treaty interpretation that I mentioned earlier. Second remark, and irrespective of whether or not the method of interpretation are useful, this reliance on the text can be seen, as argued by Professor Zabiev in reference with the work of Stephen Neff, as leading to a shift from rule consent to regime consent. Such a regime consent is seen as authorizing international courts and tribunals to inferentially interpret treaty provisions, the result being that state can be said to be bound by the inferential consequences of its treaty commitment, to which they would not have been said to have consented to under the rule consent approach. No doubt this leads to an empowerment of international courts and tribunals. Again, the legal principles, the values, the interests they rely on being key in this inferential practice. It is all the more true as there is only one step between grounding an interpretation on the conviction by implication that state must have given their consent and grounding an interpretation on the conviction that states should have given their consent, a trend which clearly exists in international legal adjudication. As with regard to consent to jurisdictions, such interpretations can provide a picture of state consent that states do not recognize. And here again, one can call international courts and tribunals to be cautious in order to ensure that states continue to trust them, trust which, as explained by Professor Lefkowitz, is paramount to ground the consent of states to international authorities. Conclusion of the conclusions. As a matter of reality, and as a matter of legitimacy, state consent are central in international law. As we have discussed this reality, the way states exercise their autonomy is sometimes often problematic. Indeed, and even though state consent has provided a modicum of order and stability, as noted both by Professor Ollis and Bordin, it prevents Our slowed-down action, we should yet be taken quickly to tackle societal emergencies. It is also problematic in as much as explained by Professor Besson and Marty, state consent displays a democratic deficit. But also importantly, state consent has also a democratic value. Indeed, to use the words of Professor Cristiano, states remain the most important institutional mechanism for making large-scale political entities directly accountable to people. This is why state consent is central, also from a legitimacy point of view. Taking into account these two sides of state consent, positive and negative, Professor Besson and Marty makes a powerful call for the establishment of a multi-public system of representation and sovereignty based on participation, in which non-state actors would complement or correct the role played by states. This approach is mutatis mutandis, shared by other panelists, for instance, Professor Lefkowitz, who argues that justice is most likely to be realized through the development of a multi-level institutional structure. For him, such a structure would generate the best possible integration of information and understanding that human beings can achieve. Likewise, Professor Chemillet-Gendreau asked for the reshuffling of political communities at several territorial levels. She urges, and we heard that this morning, to think of an international society in its universality and its plurality so that all can express themselves having the feeling to belong to the human community. The feeling to belong to the human community. I would like to close my general remarks with a few thoughts on this. From a descriptive point of view, and not a normative one, it suffices to look at the wave of populism all over the world to realize that, for the time being, this feeling to belong to the human community does not exist, or that it hardly exists. But is there any possibility that it may flourish in the future? Well, maybe. How? Why? Two reasons. First reason, not the most cheery one, to say the least, pain. Indeed, the pain that we are increasingly collectively facing may foster the feeling that we belong to the human community. And to realize this, think, for instance, about Ernest Renan, one of the most influential thinkers of nationhood. In a famous conference that he delivered at La Sorbonne in 1882 about what a nation is, he claimed, "Avoir souffert ensemble." Oui, la souffrance en commun unit plus que la joie. Second reason why the feeling to belong to the human community may flourish in the future. Participation. Indeed, the virtue of participation is not only to foster democracy in international law, but it may also well be to foster the feeling of the individuals, of the peoples, that they belong to one human community. How? To understand this, the work of Hannah Arendt is very paramount, in particular in relation that she established between will and freedom, la volonté et la liberté, and in particular in the way her work has been relied on by the late French philosopher Etienne Tassin. His work is very insightful, and I was very pleased to see it mentioned by Professor Chemillet-Gendreau. Etienne Tassin analyzed the belief in the will, la croyance en la volonté, and conceptualize the people, we heard it this morning, who does not want, le peuple qui ne veut pas. But, interestingly, he made a distinction between two types of people. The people who comes to exist because it wants to, le peuple naissant de son vouloir, and the people who comes to exist because it acts, le peuple naissant de son action. On the basis of this distinction, he formulated very interesting propositions that I have been working on in relation to international law, and I would like to share with you to conclude. Il convient de penser le peuple, non pas sous couvert d'une entité subjective, mais d'une pluralité active. Non pas sous couvert d'une domination souveraine, mais d'une liberté entendue comme pouvoir de commencer. Non pas sous couvert d'une volonté autonome, mais sous couvert d'une interaction conflictuelle de la pluralité. Je vous remercie. Thank you very much.